This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. On today's program, I'll be talking to a couple of my favorite guest experts. Joining me momentarily is best-selling author Harry Dent. And joining me later in today's program, Mr. Mish Shedlock of MishTalk.com. You know, there's a lot of threats to your retirement that exist around the world today. There's a lot of things that could happen that could, in my view, let us see a repeat of what happened back in 2007 and 2008, which you all remember had us in the midst of a financial crisis and banking failures. Today, we have a Brexit vote with the UK officially leaving the Eurozone. We have Deutsche Bank, a very large European bank in a very precarious position. We have Italian banks on life support. And we have derivative exposure at U.S. banks that is now higher than it was during the financial crisis. There are a lot of threats that exist to your retirement. And the question may not be, are we going to see a repeat of 2007 and 2008? The question may be, when are we going to see a repeat of 2007 and 2008? And the follow-up question to that is, obviously, how will you be affected? I'd like to invite you to check out an additional resource that we have available. It's our New Retirement Rules class. If you'd like to get more information or check it out, you can go to newretirementrulesradio.com. NewRetirementRulesRadio.com is the website. You can register for an upcoming event in your area or get more information at that website. Once again, NewRetirementRulesRadio.com. I'm always excited to have Mr. Harry Dent join me on the program. Harry is a best-selling author many times over. You can read his free daily newsletter and become a subscriber at harrydent.com, harrydent.com. And Harry, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, nice to be back, Dennis.
Harry, let's start by talking about what's happened to bond yields. A couple weeks ago, we saw the U.S. 30-year Treasury bond yielding 2.42%, a drop to 2.11%. It reversed significantly last week. Have we seen the low in yields or the high in bonds?
Well, I think we've seen the low in yields for a good period of time. I think eventually our forecast of actually moving into a deflationary period after all this quantitative easing blows itself out, because all it's been doing is fighting deflation. That's why the gold bugs have not seen the inflation they expected from unprecedented money printing. I think bond yields may have just bottomed. That was a new low, even lower than I think it was late 2012 when the 10-year, which I watched more, hit 1.38 and then bounced up to 3%. Well, we just hit 1.36, and I think we could bounce back up to 3% or so again. I've been predicting this actually over the last year or two, that in the early stages of the next crisis, that sovereign bonds would come into question, partly because of rising deficits and defaults, which Italy's already the next clear major default nation in Europe, but also because of another simpler reason, that the central banks and the Federal Reserve here have created a something-for-nothing, low-risk, highly leveraged bond trade around the world with hedge funds and traders, where they can first borrow money at near 0% in the lowest-cost currency in the world, lever up 30 times, and then buy treasury bonds or German bonds or Japanese bonds or whatever, even at low interest rates, and leverage those interest rates and yields 30 times, and bet on governments continuing to push down yields because they're buying their own bonds and pushing them down, not market forces and not in line with real inflation trends and everything else. So it's created this no-brainer, nutless monkey, I call it, bond trade. And what these traders are doing in hedge funds in mass is simply just buying futures ahead of the central banks. Every time central banks say, well, we're going to buy this many more bonds, like Europe's going to buy another billion won a year, and Japan's going to triple since 2013 their bond buying. They just bet on that and say, okay, we're going to buy futures ahead of the curve and be there when they buy these bonds at higher prices and lower yields. And so how can we lose? Because governments have to keep doing this, and governments are pledging to do this. Well, you lose when everybody piles in on 30 times leverage and there's no more money to go in. Now, I've been warning about this for a long time, but what I saw in the last month was that when you look at, like, everything, you can look at the smart money and dumb money. Well, for futures traders, there are the commercials, the real producers who are hedging their own production in oil or corn or wheat or copper or whatever, or like the airlines hedging against rising oil prices. These are the sophisticated professional hedgers who are doing it for real reasons. They're the smart money. They're the minority. But broadly, there's all these hedge funds and traders. They call them the large specs. They're the dumb money. And the hedge funds used to be the smart money years ago when they started out, but now everybody's a hedge fund. And hedge funds are sucking wind, losing money. And so here's the scenario. Hedge funds keep underperforming, which means they lose investors. And they're losing investors, and major hedge funds. Some of them are failing. Others are laying off staff. They're sucking wind. When they lose customers, they have to sell these highly leveraged 30 times positions, whether in treasury bonds or German bonds or something else or copper or something. And they have to sell them at a loss to meet redemptions. But the more they sell, the more losses they have and the more customers they lose. So you get this dynamic negative spiral where it doesn't take higher inflation. It doesn't take a major default of a country like Greece or next Italy, even though that's going to happen. Even before that happens, this huge bond trade, this highly leveraged, no risk, something for nothing, any idiot can make money in the last 8-9 years buying sovereign bonds at high leverage and just sitting on them. Now that could start unwinding, and I think that's what may have happened the last week. For no reason, no change in inflation or anything else, we finally just hit that point where the last idiot got in at 30 times leverage, and there's nobody really left to buy at this point. And bonds have gone negative in many countries now, so it's hard to push. It gets harder and harder to push them. In fact, Japan, after going strongly negative in recent months, for the first time saw their yen rise instead of fall, which is bad for their export, and saw their stock markets fall instead of rise on such stimulus as it has before. So there's a limit to how long you can create something for nothing and free money and zero interest rates and negative interest rates and all this sort of stuff. I think we may have just hit that point in the first week of July. I think the most important thing for investors to watch in the next several months, do sovereign bond yields, whether it's the German bund, it's slightly negative now, or the Japanese bonds, which are more than negative, or the U.S., which merely got to negative adjusted for inflation on the 10 and 30 years, are they going to just keep going up, whether there's inflation or not, whether there's more stimulus or less or anything else? Are they just going to go up because this trade is over and these hedge funds are going to basically have shot themselves in the foot? And the governments have shot themselves in the foot for letting these people go into such leveraged trades and not regulating it and encouraging it. I think this may be the trigger that then triggers everything else I'm talking about, the China real estate and stock bubble bursting. And the stock bubbles look like it's ready to burst any day to me. Real estate will follow. The fracking bubble defaulting in the United States, Southern Europe, Italy becoming the next Greece and causing a whole round of sovereign defaults and rate spikes there and deficits and all this sort of stuff. And finally, Germany being the next Japan, having the worst demographics of any major country, and they're supposed to hold together Europe. So all of this stuff is guaranteed to happen to me. All these long-term fundamentals are going to cause the economy to falter and quantitative easing to fail. But I think it may be this potential near-term reversal in the sovereign bond markets around the world, including the U.S. Treasury bond, the best house in a bad neighborhood, that may be the thing that triggers everything, because the central banks have created this monster. So how do they fight it?
Well, we're chatting today with Mr. Harry Dent, and the bad news is we're just about out of time for this segment. The good news is we've got Harry for another segment. If you would like to get Harry's free newsletter, you can visit harrydent.com. You can also get a free copy of Harry's latest book, The Demographic Cliff. You pay just a shipping and handling charge, so I'd encourage you to check that out. The website, again, is harrydent.com. I'll continue my conversation with Harry when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. This is Everything Financial Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Let me remind you that we offer a free resource to help you maximize the benefits that you'll ultimately receive from Social Security. If you are between the ages of 55 and 69, I would encourage you to check out the information at socialsecurityradio.com. Joining me on today's Everything Financial Radio program is Mr. Harry Dent. Harry is the author of the best-selling book, The Demographic Cliff, and you can get a free subscription to his newsletter at harrydent.com. Harry, you mentioned something in the last segment that I think maybe some listeners don't understand. You used a term called the fracking bubble. Can you explain?
Yeah, you know, we've been told for a number of years now that the United States is in an energy revolution, horizontal drilling instead of vertical, fracking, and all this thing about we shove a lot of sand and water down into these wells, and it frees up all this rock, breaks it up, and causes, you know, new oil reserves. Okay, great, but it's not a low-cost oil production technology. It only worked when oil was spiking up to $100 plus, and it only worked when central bank policies like the Federal Reserve, quantitative easing, pushed junk bond rates from 8 to 10% down to 5 to 6%. That makes a huge difference. These companies borrow money at junk bond rates at high risk to drill wells. So if you're borrowing at 8 to 10% and now 12% now that there's been some defaults instead of 5 to 6, that changes the business entirely. If oil's at $20 to $50 a barrel as it's been for in recent times versus $70 to $147, that changes the dynamics. So fracking would have never been viable without government stimulus around the world that pushed down junk bond rates for borrowing and made credit more available and pushed oil back up from $32 in late 2008 to $147 and eventually even to $110 in 2011 before it started crashing again. We've been predicting for years, Dennis, you know, that oil is a bubble like gold and commodities and stocks and real estate and everything in this something for nothing, low interest rate, stimulative world, and speculative world, and that oil is going to go back down to $10 to $20 a barrel, and gold is going to go back down to $400 or something like that. And people don't believe that, so what happens? Well, iron ore is already down 80%, and most commodities down 70%, so bubbles do burst. It's just stocks and real estate have yet to burst again, and the bond bubble here is bursting simply because central banks and hedge fund traders push down rates too low to be sustainable now that they're increasingly negative. So this bond thing's going to reverse, and the fracking bubble with it is already reversing and starting to default. But wait until we go into the next downturn and wait until junk bond rates on energy and fracking bonds go from 12% today to 20 or 30 like they did for Greece in 2011. So this fracking thing is over. These companies would have never been viable without these bubble conditions, and they'll never be viable again because even the princes in Saudi Arabia says we'll never see $100 oil again, ever. I think you might see it 30, 40 years from now, but I agree, though. You're not going to see it in the next decade, so these industries are going to go down.
So, Harry, you believe that real estate and stocks then are likely to have a repeat performance of what we saw back in 2006, 7, 8?
Yeah, except worse, because we've had three bubbles now in stocks, one that peaked in early 2000 with the tech bubble, the baby boom last wave of spending and second bubble into late 2007 before they ran out of steam, and now the totally artificial quantitative easing bubble and zero interest rate bubble that's peaking between 2015 and 16 in every major market in the world in stocks. And stocks like low treasury bonds, because that's how they discount their earnings in the future. So a 1.38% treasury bond versus 3% has a huge difference on stock valuations, that has a huge difference for real estate and affordability and mortgage costs, and so on and so on, and for business and stock buybacks, all this sort of stuff. So all this low interest rate thing is going to backfire because you can't have free money forever. You can't push down interest rates to negative, for crying out loud, forever. And this is going to reverse. And when it does, all the bubbles that came with it reverse as well. That's why if the Treasury bond really is going to start heading back up, even if 3 months from now Janet Yellen says, oh, well, we're going to renew quantitative easing, they're not going to care by then. Hedge fund managers are going to be selling these high 30 times bond trading positions just to meet redemptions already. They're not going to care whether there's quantitative easing another round or not. It's going to be too late.
So, Harry, you think that at this point the Fed is painted into a corner and that the possibility of more easy money policies, the possibility of more money printing is just off the table because it won't work, or do you think they'll try it?
I think they will try it. I think they may be too late. I do have two scenarios that we are seeing a peak in stocks. Most stocks peaked back in early to mid 2015, but the Dow and S&P are the only major stock markets in the world that made slight new highs recently. Scenario number one, stocks have finally peaked, if they didn't already peak a year prior, and we're going to see a more serious crash start in the second half of this year and continue throughout 2017 and off and on all the way into at least late 2019, early 2020. The greatest crash in stocks and everything else since the early 30s. Scenario two says, okay, stocks do start to crash, bond yields do start to come up, but central banks are very quick and strong to react, and they're able to create, you know, stocks maybe go down 10 or 15%, very strong support around 1,800 on the S&P 500, and try to make one more new high in the late this year, and then you have an even bigger bubble. I mean, they have painted themselves in a corner. This was inevitable from the beginning because you don't get something for nothing, damn it. I'd stand by that. Nothing in life, my whole life, has ever taught me that you get something for nothing. You do get money from investment, innovation, hard work, savings, all types of things, but you don't get something sitting in your house trading tech stocks or flipping houses or frackers, borrowing at 5% and building oil wells that aren't viable long-term. So it's inevitable that they're going to shoot themselves in the foot. It just looks like to me it's happening now or starting to, and either we're seeing the peak now in stocks or we get back near these levels after one more crash later this year. But I think in the next three and a half years, you're going to see the biggest crash in history because there's nowhere to go but down here. The demographic trends only get worse. Debt is only much higher than it was in the last bubble, and now we have the inability for Feds and central banks to push money strongly into negative interest rates. Again, first sign to me, Japan went into negative interest rates strongly, and their stocks went down instead of up, and their currency went up instead of down, the exact intended opposite. That shows you that it's ending. You can no longer push these rates down lower without heavy consequences.
Well, our guest today has been Mr. Harry Dent. I would encourage you to subscribe to his free newsletter at harrydent.com. You can also, at that website, request a complimentary copy of his book, The Demographic Cliff. You pay only a shipping and handling charge. And, Harry, always a pleasure to chat with you. Thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thanks again, Dennis.
If you're not yet a subscriber to my Portfolio Watch newsletter, it's easy to become a subscriber. All you need to do is visit the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourportfoliowatch.com. When you subscribe every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, you will have delivered to your email inbox my complete market update and economic commentary. The newsletter focuses on what we're doing in some of our managed portfolios, what you might consider doing, as well as full economic commentary and analysis. If you would like to become a subscriber again, simply visit the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. That's Y-O-U-R, portfoliowatch.com. I'll be back after these words. This is Everything Financial Radio. I am Dennis Tubergen. This is Everything Financial Radio. Thanks for listening in today. You know, if you'd like to go back and catch any of the interviews that I do with the guest experts that appear here on the Everything Financial Radio program, it's easy to do that. All you need to do is visit the website, everythingfinancialradio.com. The website, again, everythingfinancialradio.com. And all of the past interviews that I've done with our guest experts here on the program are archived at that website. Returning to the program today is Mish Shedlock. You can read his very prolific writings at his blog site. It is mishtalk.com. That's M-I-S-H-talk.com. And Mish, welcome back to the program.
Hey, a pleasure to be back on, Dennis. A lot of stuff going on here, especially in regards to Brexit, the UK voting to leave the EU. That's what's been on my mind.
Well, you know, for our listeners maybe that aren't familiar with it, the British people voted to leave the European Union, and that sounds like, okay, we all understand what that is, but explain, Mish, to the listeners what that really means.
Well, it's the EU is, well, a conglomerate of, it was 28, it's going to be 27 nations here, that all agree on to abide by certain rules, and it's what was started out to be, you know, a trade agreement and also freedom of movement has morphed into so many other things. And one of the difficulties with it is every nation in the EU has to agree to a change to get it done. And so here, you know, they all have to agree now on the terms of the UK actually leaving the EU. So it's really a boondoggle nightmare. And I'm a big fan of free trade. And free trade would fit on a napkin. You know, effective immediately, all tariffs and all subsidies and all goods and services are ended today. That is a free trade agreement in my mind. But the EU is supposed to be about free trade, but it's really not. They've got special rules in there that protect French farmers. So everyone in the EU pays a higher price for fruits and vegetables because France has rules in there that protect small, inefficient French farms. So they've got rules on all this global warming stuff, whether someone wants to do it or not, rules on this, that, and the everything. What got the UK riled up enough to actually leave the EU wasn't that stuff. It was migration policies. These German Chancellor Angela Merkel welcomed all of these refugees from Syria. Millions of them poured in, and some of them were, you know, getting to the UK, and the UK was very worried about this. And the UK said, look, we want control of our own borders, and the EU said, no, you can't do that. So they put this to a vote, and had it, and the timing of the vote, depending on whether or not you were in favor of the EU leaving or not, was either extremely fortunate or extremely unfortunate, because it came exactly as all these people were riled up over all these immigrants coming in, getting free benefits, and the fear from the people was they're taking our jobs. So that's what caused the vote. But Brexit is really a symptom, Dennis. People are mad everywhere. They're mad in the United States. That's what explains the rise of Donald Trump. That explains why Bernie Sanders was so popular. It explains why an anti-immigration candidate is leading the pack in Austrian elections. It explains the rise of Marine Le Pen. France now wants, or at least Marine Le Pen, she's got the largest National Front policy, wants to have a vote in France, for France to get off the euro, to get out of the EU. We've got Italian banks that are on the verge of imploding. And everywhere you look, people are angry because they feel like they've been left behind and, you know, only the wealthy are getting ahead. That's what's really driving all of these things, both in Europe and the United States.
You know, Mish, when you say there's 27 nations in the European Union, they all have to approve something. I think it was Colin Powell who once said that a camel is a horse designed by a committee. I mean, the point being that it's really, really difficult to get agreement with that many different parties involved. And you had, before we started to actually record the conversation today, you'd made a given an example that President Obama, made some comments, and, mm-hmm. and it kind of illustrated that. Can you expand on that for the listeners? I thought that was interesting.
Sure. On back in April, President Obama said that he was part of the fear-mongering campaign. He actually flew over to Europe to give speeches, warning the UK that it would be in the back of the queue if it voted for Brexit. And he repeated that warning on June 25th, the day that Brexit vote took place. And he said that he still stands by his back of the queue Brexit warning. And curiously enough, Dennis, on July 1st, a U.S.-UK trade bill is already making its way in Congress. Why? Because the U.S. wants to have trade with the U.K. And this will be a lot easier to work out because it's one nation on one nation working out, you know, an agreement, as opposed to trying to come up with something that 27 nations have to agree with. This is one of the problems of Obama's pet project, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, with all of the Asian nations. You know, there's so much muck in there. 5,544 pages of stuff. When it takes that long, it can't all be about free trade, and indeed it's not. You know, every nation in there, you know, wants to protect something. And the curiosity here, Dennis, is Hillary Clinton's against Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Now, while she was Secretary of State under President Obama, she was all in for it. But now that she's on her own here, she's not. Donald Trump is against it. Bernie Sanders are against it. Now, they're all against it because they think it has something to do with free trade. I'm against it because it has anything else to do but free trade. They've buried global warming in this stuff. But the big fear here is TPP actually creates a supranational court for corporations to sue governments. One of the big tenets here of the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement allows companies to sue governments if governmental policies are affecting their profits. Let me give you an example. So let's say, you know, Philip Morris or a cigarette manufacturer. Let's say Australia comes out with a ruling that requires a sterner cancer warning on a pack of cigarettes. Corporations can now sue Australia, and the same applies to the United States. You know, if the U.S. passes a law that some, you know, foreign company doesn't like, they can sue the United States. This TPP is a legal disaster and nightmare. That's why I'm against it. It's because it has nothing to do with free trade. All of this stuff that's going to do nothing but appeal to lawyers. You know, we desperately need this thing scrapped. Fortunately, it looks like this thing is not going to make its way, you know, through Congress this year. And if so, it'll effectively be dead because all of the candidates running don't want to have anything to do with this thing now.
Well, we are chatting today with Mish Shedlock. The website to check out Mish's work and his writings is mishtalk.com. We will continue our conversation with Mish shortly. You are listening to Everything Financial Radio. You are listening to Everything Financial Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you're listening in today. I'll get back to my conversation with Mr. Mitch Shedlock momentarily. Before I do, though, I'm sure many of you probably read the same news stories I do or listen to many of these news reports on television or radio, that although the world economy is recovering, it is a rather tepid recovery. Well, I would argue that the global economy is not recovering. And there are a lot of news stories to back that up as well. However, those aren't the news stories that are typically featured on mainstream outlets. However, there was a Bloomberg story that was published just a few weeks ago on July 10, and the article said that the G20 trade ministers see global investment falling up to 15%. I'll give you just a sentence from the article, the Bloomberg article. Global cross-border investment may decline by as much as 15% this year as trade remains sluggish, China's commerce minister said after a group of 20 trade ministers meeting on Sunday. I would argue that if the global economy was recovering, global investment would be increasing, not declining, much less declining by up to 15% in a year. That's a red flag. That's a red flag that, in my view, and certainly in the view of our prior guest here on the program today, Harry Dent, that U.S. markets are overvalued. And certainly, when you look around the world, the economic signs seem to indicate that the economy is moving in another direction. If you'd like to learn more, we have a resource available to you. It's our new retirement rules class. You can get more information or register for an upcoming event in your area at newretirementrulesradio.com. The website, again, is newretirementrulesradio.com. I'm chatting once again today with Mitch Shedlock. His website is mishtalk.com. Mitch is always a lot of fun to have on the program, and he works harder than I think just about anyone I know at researching and writing. And Mitch, in the last segment, we were talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. You mentioned that it's got an eye-popping 5,544 pages dealing with free trade. And, you know, I've always been of the opinion that these free trade agreements, I agree with you, they're not about free trade. It just always seemed to me, having a bit of a cynical perspective, that these are really all about protecting special interest groups that kind of coddle the politicians that negotiate these agreements. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely correct. The sugar lobby is one of the big ones. We produce sugar here in the United States. We've got the world's highest prices for sugar, actually, because we grow it so inefficiently here. I mean, sugar generally grows best in warm, humid climates. I mean, we can grow some in from sugar cane in Hawaii, but what it takes for us to grow this is way more inefficient, say, than someplace like Brazil or someplace else. There's actually two prices for sugar that people don't know. There's a world price and there's a U.S. price, and the rest of the world wants to ship sugar to the United States, but they can't, because we've got massive tariffs on the price of sugar. Well, what did that do? That protects a few sugar growers here in the United States, but at the expense of every candy producer in the United States. Chicago alone lost, all kinds of candy production because they can't compete. It went to these candy manufacturers left the Chicago area, actually went to Canada, where they can buy sugar cheaper than they can here in the United States. There's protections in there on steel, and President Obama, it sounds like all the rest of the protectionists here, he wants a 500% tariff on Chinese steel because apparently the claim is they're dumping it. Well, so what? Look at it from the perspective of a U.S. car manufacturer, GM, Ford. If we have these 500% tariffs on steel, they're going to have to pay more for steel than Toyota will. So at the expense of at the cost of saving a few steel manufacturing jobs, we're going to hurt our own auto industry. It's all about these little fiefdoms trying to protect their little piece of the pie. It's all about protection, very little of it about free trade. And the irony of all of this is Obama just yesterday was complaining that China has export tariffs on to, you know, drive up the cost of certain, you know, rare metals and some things the U.S. does want to import because we don't have them here and China does. So here's the way everyone always wants it, Dennis. Everyone wants free trade for exports, but no country wants free trade for imports. So we want to have all of these protection schemes so that we can save our jobs, but we don't want any other country to have them so we can all export to them. And so all of these, this is why it takes 5,000 pages to do something, because we've got all of these little trade-offs here. Okay, we'll let you protect your sugar lobby if you let us protect our steel lobby. And so it's absolutely ludicrous, but that's what's behind these deals. This Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement was in the works for 6 years, all in secret. No one was even allowed to see these pages until they finally put this thing together for fear that it would collapse the deal, because, you know, and the only one benefited from this final piece of paper were all the lawyers and all the people who worked on this damn thing. Crazy.
Mish, let me shift gears in the time we have left and talk a little bit about U.S. stock markets. We saw all-time highs, at least on a nominal basis. To what extent do you think Fed policy is still driving this run-up in the market with low interest rates and companies able to buy back their own stock? And how much longer is it going to last?
I don't know. And certainly this is something that I've gotten wrong. And, you know, I think I've called the global economy as good as anyone. I've certainly not called the U.S. stock market as good as some others. I never thought the stock market would get as high as it did. And yet, I warned people, don't short it. But, you know, watching something run up and everyone, you know, point a finger at you as if you're a fool, I don't know, maybe I am, Dennis. But, you know, the higher it goes, the bigger the ultimate correction. The one thing we do know is the median PEs are at an all-time high. And the on a cyclical PE basis, if we smooth out the earnings, say, over a 10-year period and look at what the PEs are, those PE ratios are higher now than any point in history except for 1929, 2000 in the dot-com bubble, and 2007 in the housing bubble. And in a way, things are actually worse now because darn near every stock in every sector. It's not just technology stocks that were like in 2000 that were in a bubble. It's darn near everything now. And yeah, central bank liquidity is certainly behind this. I don't know what it takes, you know, to prick this bubble, but you know, every time you know we had these fears that the Fed was going to hike, the stock market would throw a hissy fit, the Fed would actually delay. Then finally we got around this year, the Fed was insistent that they were going to hike four times. Well, I believe I was on your radio show, and I said, I don't think so. And now, you know, the market is saying there aren't going to be any hikes all the way out to June of 2017. We'll see, but yeah, it's central bank liquidity that's sloshing around, but all they've done, Dennis, is create another bubble that, you know, I don't know if it'll crash. That might be the wrong word. my preferred scenario here now is maybe we lose, the stock market loses 5 or 10% this year, 10% next year, then rallies 5, then loses 15, then gains 7, and then loses 15. And at the end of 7 years, all of a sudden, you know, there's not going to be a crash in there. There might not even be a 20% correction in there. You know, but at the end of 7 years, people are going to look and say, my God, I'm down 40%. So, you know, the end result's going to feel like a crash, but there's never going to be one. And the reason why I have that as my preferred scenario is corporations are able to raise cash easily right now in this bond market. Now, if that changes, I'll change my tune and be looking more for a crash. But what happened in March of 2009 is the bond market dried up. Corporations couldn't get cash. We had both viable and unviable companies that couldn't go to the bond market to raise money and couldn't pay back their debts. So stocks were priced as if these companies were at risk of going out of business. So the one thing that Bernanke did do was revive the corporate bond market so that companies can get financing. Now they've gone to this extreme where they can get financing so easily, they're getting financing to buy back shares of their own shares at absurd prices. So if that liquidity remains, you know, we might have an earnings scare, you know, where the stock market does this, you know, slow decline over a number of years, kind of like Japan did. But as long as there's liquidity, enough liquidity in the bond market, we probably won't see a crash like we did before. At least that's how I see it, Dennis.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Mish Shedlock. You can read Mish's work at mishtalk.com. That's mishtalk.com. I'd encourage you to do that. And Mish, always a pleasure to have you on the program, and I'm looking forward to having you back again.
Hey, Dennis, always a pleasure. Call me anytime.
Well, that's all I have for the program this week. I'm glad you decided to tune in today. Before I go, let me remind you that if you're between the ages of 55 and 69 and would like to get a perspective as to whether or not you're getting maximum benefits from Social Security if you're already collecting them, or if you have the right plan to maximize benefits from Social Security when you do collect, go check out our free resource at socialsecurityradio.com. The website, again, is socialsecurityradio.com. Again, that's all the time I have for the show this week. Hope you got something you can use. I'll be back again next week. Bye.